Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2118A directs the State Department of Agriculture, in consultation with the Oregon Weed Board, to implement a study on the economic and environmental impacts of noxious weeds and the effectiveness and efficiency of current weed control practices. Directs State Department of Agriculture to make recommendations to the 71st Legislative Assembly regarding a comprehensive strategy to reduce number and severity of weed control emergencies. And first up to testify, we have Chuck Craig and Dan Hilburn with the State Department of Agriculture.
Welcome, you two. You know the process. State your name for the record, and I'll let you decide who's going to go first, and look forward to hearing from you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Chuck Craig, Assistant Director for Department of Agriculture. With me is Dan Hilburn, the Administrator of our Plant Division. House Bill 2118 has gone through a very considerable change in emphasis since we originally introduced the bill, and I will let Dan Hilburn describe what it is now compared with what it used to be. So, Dan, go ahead.
For the record, my name is Dan Hilburn. I'm with the Oregon Department of Agriculture. House Bill 2118 started out as a bill to give the state parallel authority to the counties for enforcing noxious weed control emergencies. Right now, the current laws have the enforcement authority at the county level. It ran into some opposition from some of the agricultural industry groups. We worked to try to find a consensus, and though everyone agreed that noxious weeds were a very serious problem, there was not a consensus on how to approach these issues. So what we've done is gotten stuff to bill, and it is now a study bill, which directs the Department of Agriculture, working with the State Weed Board, to look at all the weed control programs in the state, the state programs, county programs, federal agency programs, evaluate those programs, and come up with a plan for how to proceed in the future to spend the resources that we have in the best way possible. So that's the idea behind this bill. It has a general consensus among the agricultural industries that this is what we need to proceed and make the best use of the resources that are available to us.
I look around and I see how in the past, I mean, we're talking about going back to the 40s and the 50s and the 60s and how we dealt with them. There is a big team of it. Falling behind the curve. We have, you see,
Mr. Chair, I would agree with you, and I think if you look at the strength of the county programs around the state right now, you'll find that they have had a lot of budget cuts, and that's been declining. And at the same time, the State Department of Agriculture Noxious Weed Control Program has also had significant budget cuts in the last two biennia. So I think your observation is correct, and the weeds don't slow down. They continue to get worse.
I guess, Mr. Chair, I just wonder how far all the study money would actually go on weed eradication.
Mr. Chair, Senator Fisher, we're not asking for any money, and I feel the same way you do, that we shouldn't be wasting a lot of the resources that ought to be going toward weeds on a study. So we're planning to do this with existing staff, and we have a budget request in for some more money for grant money, and if we need to, we would have an outside researcher apply for a grant to get this study done, if that's the way the groups want this study to go. So we're not asking for additional money at this point for this study.
Okay, thank you very much. And then you said PTEP was going to be on next.
Mr. Chair, Pete Test with the Oregon Farm Bureau, as well as Gene Wilkinson with the Oregon Cattlemen's Association.
For the record, Pete Test, Associate Director of Oregon Farm Bureau Federation, Chairman George, members of the committee, just wanted to briefly say that we support this bill. The original bill was an effort by the department to set up a process by which the state could be more involved in the weed process, but I think they got a little ahead of them. They had not really talked with a lot of people to get everybody on board. I think with this process, we'll get people together, hopefully come up with a solution everybody agrees to, and end up with something by the next session. So we really support this bill today, the way it's been put together.
Thanks. Basically, what happened was you thought they were pushing. How's the bill switch to a study?
Chair George, yeah, I think that was moving our clientele just a little faster than they wanted. They moved. Many of them agreed, but some of them didn't, and it's kind of one of those things where everybody kind of should be on board with this before we make this kind of a move with it. So this was probably the best way to go, and we'll get the job done. It just might take us just a little bit longer.
Chairman George, members of the committee, I'm Jean Underhill Wilkinson with the Oregon Cattlemen's Association. We also support the Senate Bill 2118. As it's been amended, as Pete Test just emphasized, we hope at the end of this process that whatever solutions are found by this study program, that it will emphasize local cooperation, local funding assistance to farmers and ranchers who are very, very interested in eradication of noxious weeds. We also hope that in the end and sometime soon, state organizations who are funding watershed restoration assistance will recognize that eradication of noxious weeds are a very necessary part of watershed health, and there'll be more funding assistance in the future from those entities. Thank you.
Any questions?
If you don't mind just sitting there for a little bit. Was there anyone else who wanted to say?
I think it's Senator Mayes.
Yes, we're going to do that. Yeah, we'll go to that next seat. I'm going to go ahead and...
Any problem?
Okay. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2118, and I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2118.
To the floor with a detailed recommendation.
Senator Wild has moved House Bill 2118, and that is A, right?
A.
To the floor with a due pass. Is there any further discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
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 House Bill 2118, A, is a third pass, and who would like to carry this? Senator Wild will carry House Bill 2118. I'm going to close a work session on House Bill 2118, and I'm going to open a work session on Brad, tell us where we are in relationship. Well, I keep doing that, and that's the wrong mic. We have amendments. While Brad is looking that up, we had a comment that was made about the bill, and I've reviewed this, and I'd like to clarify a few things. The comment was made that there was a mistake, and it indicated that it was our staff that had done that. And looking at the bill as to what was given to us as far as the drafting of it, I think that we did reflect what was the intent of that with what we passed out of here. But it is our pleasure to bring the Senate Joint Memorial 13 back and for additional modification.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Joint Memorial 13A urges the President and Congress to fund goose depredation programs. Specifically, the bill requests $1 million in funding for cooperative work between state and federal agencies, as well as an additional $14 million for a joint program to reseed existing bird sanctuaries and refuges in an attempt to lure migrating geese away from crops, as well as funding a program in which the United States Department of Agriculture and Wildlife Services contracts with growers to purchase growing crops to feed Canada geese in Oregon and Washington. The initial discrepancy in the bill, as it was in 13A, was that the $14 million in subsection B of the bill appeared to refer only to receiving bird sanctuaries and refuges, and the contracting program with U.S. Department of Agriculture appeared to be unfunded. We have -3 amendments submitted by Senator Yee and the Farm Bureau, which seek to clarify that the $14 million could go jointly to those two programs, not one or the other. And Mr. Chair, I might point out that we have a Scrivener's error on the -3 amendments. Line 3, the way it's worded, it says, and funds increased seeding. That should read, and funds for increased seeding.
Looks like the S is in struck and fund. Is that just my copy?
We're unable to get a clean copy. Somebody that had had possession of this earlier had crossed that out as a suggested correction of the amendment.
So right here, I heard we funds for increased seeding.
Correct, Mr. Chair. That's more consistent with the language in the rest of the bill.
Welcome, Senator Yee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Senator May Yee, representing Senate District 19. I think that Greg explained the amendment very well. I think the $14 million is meant for a combination of seeding, contracting with the farmers, and with the sanctuary and the refuge to do the seeding to help feed the Canadian geese. So I'd like to urge your support of the amendment.
Right, I think this says that flexibility, if we can just convince them to suspend it, we at least will give them an option. You're going to have accommodation.
Yes, but the $14 million is not to give to the sanctuary and the refuge to do the seeding to the farmers. Mm-hmm. With the advice of the advisory committee. And I understand the advisory committee is made up mainly of farmers, so they know the situation and they can make good recommendations.
Questions?
Mm-hmm.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I will move the conceptual amendments on the A3 amendment. Oh, so the lack of having 4 in there is considered a Scrivener's error. Okay, now that we've clarified that, I will move the A3 amendment to SJM 13, noting that we have a Scrivener's error on line 3 after the, in quotation marks, and funds, F-O-R, will be inserted at that point. And
okay.
That is my motion.
Senator Wild has moved the -3 amendment. -A3 amendment to Senate Joint Memorial 13, and on line 3, after in quotations and funds, and the F is on the funds, shall add the word FOR4. Does everyone understand that? Is there any objection? So move.
I will move SJM 13A as amended to the floor to do pass recommendation.
Senator Wild has moved SJM 13 as amended to the floor with a due pass. Not,
aye.
Aye.
Senator Wild?
Aye.
Senator Jordan? Aye. Senate Joint Memorial 13A has been moved forward with a due time. And on Senator Yee, you will carry it again.
Okay.
Thanks. Okay. And I will close.
Thank you.
And I will close the work session on Senate Joint Memorial 13. And who do you, anybody that we need to consider right now? I'm going to open a public hearing, a possible work session on House Bill 2119. Brad, tell us where we are.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2119A modifies the definition of exotic animals for the purposes of the Department of Agriculture. Requires that an exotic animal be kept in a reasonable and prudent manner to avoid physical and financial risk to the public from an escape. Eliminates provision allowing a person to keep an exotic animal after applying for a permit, but before the permit is issued. Imposes strict liability on keepers of exotic animals for costs incurred or property damage resulting from an escape and for personal injuries caused by the animal, except when animal damage results from willful unlawful acts of a person other than the keeper. Requires seller of exotic animal prior to the sale to provide the buyer with informational material approved by the Department of Agriculture on the care, husbandry, health, and nutritional needs of the animal. Increases fees for issuance and renewal of exotic animal permit from not more than $20 each to not more than $300 for issuance and $100 for renewal. And first to testify, we have Dr. Andrew Clark and Chuck Craig from the State Department of Agriculture.
Welcome, and please state your name for the record. And
thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Chuck Craig with the Department of Ag. With me is Andrew Clark, the state veterinarian with our department. House Bill 2119 began as an effort on our part to substantially revise the exotic animal statutes by deregulating the smaller animals that were not considered dangerous to the public and then increasing somewhat our ability to regulate the larger dangerous animals such as the large predatory cats and so on. In the process of working our way through this bill with the working group that involved all the interests that are associated with the issue, we discovered a dilemma that we just didn't find a solution to. So in this bill, we've dropped back to really tweaking a number of the areas of the statute that we feel need to be addressed, but that basically what we found is that if we deregulated the smaller animals, they automatically by default came into regulation under the Department of Fish and Wildlife's Wildlife Integrity Statutes. And the exotic animal owning community was not in favor of that happening, so we dropped that part of the proposal and are proceeding with some issues that are really what I would consider to be a tweaking of the existing law. And there is a drafting error in the bill that we want to point out also. So Dr. Clark will go through point by point what we've addressed.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Andrew Clark. I'm the state veterinarian at the Oregon Department of Agriculture. The ODA exotic animal permit system addressed by this bill has been subject to several reviews by the working group which was established to deal with it. The initial changes, which dealt with the deregulation of small felines and New World primates, have been completely removed, and in this draft will continue to be regulated by the Oregon Department of Agriculture. Changes to the original statute are as follows. First, the definitions of exotic animals have been simplified. Secondly, USDA registered facilities have been added to the exclusion in addition to licensed facilities. The omission of this terminology in the previous statute was an oversight, and its inclusion is now a technicality. Registered facilities are research and teaching institutions, including OHSU, other universities, private research facilities, and the like. Third, terminology has been changed so that USDA licensed and registered facilities are not excluded from the liability clauses of the statute, as was previously the case. Fourth, clarification is made that a person who wants to keep an exotic animal must have the permit before the animal is in their possession. Fifth, a new section provides for educational material to be provided to buyers of exotic animals before the sale takes place. The idea is that they be made aware of the particular responsibilities involved with exotic animal ownership prior to purchase. Sixth, in several places, risk is more specifically defined as being both physical and financial, and strict liability is added. In cases of purposeful sabotage or illegal release of the animals by other parties, the strict liability is excluded. Seventh, the permit fee is capped at $300 rather than $20 to more realistically reflect the actual costs to the Oregon Department of Agriculture. I would note that there were several hearings in the House committee, and the final agreement on this bill included wolves as being regulated under the section dealing with canines. This was inadvertently omitted in this draft of the bill and needs to be reinstated. I would ask that it be changed so that in Section 3, subpara 3, which states any bracket wolf or any canine bracket member of the canine family Kennedy, what we need to do is within the brackets cross out canine and include in the bill wolf or any. This is on line 17. Okay. So that it will read any wolf or any member of the family Kennedy, not indigenous to Oregon. That is my conclusion. I'd be happy to deal with any questions.
Can I ask you on page 2, line 11, the bill suggests that we eliminate the words or has applied for and not been refused or have had revoked or suspended. Now, why are we eliminating that?
Because this allowed for someone to be in possession of the animal before they had dealt with the permit and had a permit,
okay,
which would allow someone to have a tiger in a chicken coop, which really does not deal with the necessities of secure husbandry of the tiger.
And how about the have had revoked or suspended part of that? It's that's the applied for being able to be in possession prior,
mm-hmm.
but and there's the additional part and not been refused or have had revoked or suspended a valid State Department.
So that they have a permit which is in force at the time that they get the animal.
Okay.
That we have had the chance to deal with the permit, inspect the facility, and ensure that
you're talking about that specific permit, then?
Yes.
That they're applied. Okay. I understand. Any questions?
Yes, Senator Corcoran.
Mr. Chair. So the wolf is not a member of the family candidate?
The wolf is an indigenous animal to Oregon. And the desire is to continue regulating wolves, which are indigenous, and any other member of the family Kennedy, which is not indigenous. So what it does is include that one indigenous species and all non-indigenous species. That's the reason wolf is separated out, is because it is technically an indigenous species.
Okay. And, Mr. Chair, second question. Can you give a sense of the variety of exotic species that permits come through your department for, just so we can get a flavor for what those are?
Yes, indeed. Mr. Chairman, Senator Corcoran, we have four species of primates currently permitted. Some are old world primates, that is macaques, fairly large old world primates. We have three species of new world primates, which are the smaller ones like organ grinder monkeys and things like that. And we have one prosimian, which is from Madagascar. We have one leopard currently permitted. We have, I believe, six wolf permits out. We have no bear permits out, and we have one fennec fox, which is a fox that weighs about 3 pounds, kind of a pocket fox. That is the sort of variety that we have at this point.
And how about exotic birds? Does that fall under different?
This does not deal with exotic birds. I forgot to mention, we have a number of permits out for caracal and servals, which are moderate-sized feline species. So 15 to 20, 25 pounds. Thanks.
Okay. Yeah, just out of curiosity. I guess sometimes science doesn't make much sense, any more sense than what some of our laws do once in a while, but if a felis catus is a domestic cat, why in the world isn't a felis canis a domestic dog? I mean, couldn't they be consistent?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Fisher, I'm sorry, I haven't followed you. Felis catus is a domestic cat, and Canis familiaris is the domestic dog.
I just said, why can't they be consistent and call it Felis canis?
Oh, they're in different taxonomic families. One is the family Felidae, and the other is Canidae.
Well, at least put familiaris canis or something, then keep it description ahead of the...
Just say yes, Mr. Clark.
Yeah.
You only have to change about 150 years of history.
Okay. The reason, incidentally, that Felis catus and Canis familiaris are specifically included here is that they are introduced species. They are technically non-indigenous species. They are introduced. And so they are excluded here. Because of the fact that if we were regulating only non-indigenous species, they would be in that consideration. So they are excluded from being exotic animals, even though they are introduced.
Well, since we do have... there's not much use in pushing forward conceptual amendments because they always send it back to us to redo them here. And so what I'll do is I'm going to direct the administrator on line 17, page 1, to restore the wording wolf or any and delete canine. And that will be the change, and we will bring this back apparently on Wednesday for work session. So with that, we will close the public hearing on HB 2119A. And
thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you. What else do we have? I am going to open a work session on HB 2383. What we have is referral to judiciary, and that is the motion that the chair will entertain.
Oh, yes. I move House Bill 2383 to Judiciary without recommendation.
Okay. Senator Sharon has moved House Bill 2383 to Judiciary without recommendation. Any discussion? Objections? So ordered. That leaves us with...
Why don't we just refer all the rest of them all there?
Oh, I wouldn't mind doing that. We have two bills, SB 1028 and SB 1320. One Senator George wishes to speak on, the other Senator Farioli wishes to speak on. So at this time, I think we will... Chairman, would you like to record your votes on adding of the SBM 13 with the group deputy?
Yes, I would.
We will open a work session on SBM 13.
And I vote aye.
Senator Shannon has...
Thank you very much.
...requested unanimous consent to vote aye on SBM 13. Any objection? Mm-hmm. So ordered. Any others?
Yes, I'd like to have a... I recorded I vote on House Bill 2118.
We will open a work session on HB 2118. Senator Shannon?
Yes, and I'd like to have my vote recorded as an aye vote.
Senator Shannon has requested unanimous consent to have her vote recorded on HB 2118 as an aye vote. Any objections? So ordered. We will close the work session on this.
Should we go get Senator Lewis?
I believe at this time we will stand at ease, waiting for the arrival of other members of this body. So
we are at
ease.
No, Brad. Do you know what Senator Farioli is? I know where he is.
Oh, geez.
We'll be out of recess, and Senator Farioli, now that you're here, that Senate Bill 1520. I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 1320, and Brad, if you'll tell us where we are.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 1320 creates the position of Natural Resources Policy Administrator, defines duties, appropriates monies from the general fund. When we last met on the 13th, Senator Farioli was going to clarify for the committee that the administrator position created under this bill is similar, if not identical, to the types of duties and responsibilities for other administrators in the building, for example, the Legislative Fiscal Office and the Legislative Revenue Office and the Legislative Council Office. Additionally, we have two sets of amendments. Senator Corcoran has submitted -1 amendment, and Senator Farioli has submitted -2 amendments. Do you want me to discuss those, or have the chair discuss their amendments?
We can do that. Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, I feel comfortable testifying from the podium. Thank you, sir.
I'm sorry, I wasn't listening to you.
Senator Farioli wanted to go out to address his amendment. I wanted to learn about you. Wanted to
say. Sure.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, Ted Farioli, Senator from Senate District 28, I appreciate the opportunity to bring this issue back before the committee. I looked at Senate Bill 1320-2, and I've also looked at 1320-1. And with the exception of one change in the -1 amendments, I would be happy to support the -1 amendments, but I would like the opportunity to discuss those with the committee and share my concerns and my reasoning. The -1 amendment of Senator Corcoran's authorship and the -2 amendments of my authorship have the same changes on lines 1, 2, and 3, identically. I think the committee can look at the -1 and -2 amendment sheets and see that that's a fact. In the -1 amendments, line 4 adds an insertion that I have no objection to. As a matter of fact, it's a clarifier that talks about nonpartisanship. There's certainly no objection to that for me. On page 2 of the deck, after line 10, there was an insertion in section 4 that neither the administrator nor an employee of the administrator may oppose, urge, or attempt to influence legislation. That is certainly also captured in line 16, same language. And then the deletion of 11 through 17 eliminates, I think, a very critical element of confidentiality that I would expect from an administrator in legislative fiscal, legislative council, or in any of the other legislatively created administrators. So I would suggest that deletion of confidentiality might actually hamper the efficiency of this administrator.
Excuse me, when you were going to look to see if, in fact, this similar language appeared with other
administrators. I wasn't, Mr. Chairman. There's no standard boilerplate. Actually, there's language that each administrator who was appointed under which thinks that's standard, and in fact, when you look at them, they're all different. So the issue for us in this creation was, I believe that the criticisms that were brought by our members and our colleagues from across the aisle about bipartisanship actually needs to be acknowledged and I think supported. We are after a natural resources policy administrator that will be scrupulously fair in the treating the requests from members. That person, we're also hoping, will create continuity. And the fortunes of politics and more being what they are, it may be that they are appointed by a different appointing agency in future biennia, and I would hope that we would make such a good choice that that person would be able to continue and bring continuity. So I have no problem with making a bipartisanship and members of the minority involved in the selection. I wouldn't want to see the confidentiality issue locked. I think that's an important feature that we ought to have. Trust that no other member or other pressure in the building could be brought to force disclosure of a piece of research that an individual might predicate a piece of legislation on. And colleagues, as you know, timing is everything in this process. Your candy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. One thing that came to mind is, okay, when, say I'm working on a concept or I'm interested in the matter, and I'm dealing with legislative counsel, and they send me a letter saying, okay, we can't obviously tell you who else is interested in an identical thing, but there is someone, and would we be allowed to pass your name along to them so that perhaps you could work on it together, or we wouldn't have a redundant process going. Would you envision that taking place under this the current SB 1320 language with the privacy rights?
Chairman George, the Senator Wild, my understanding is that you can now inquire about that from legislative fiscal and legislative council whether or not anybody else is working on that, and they won't. They'll respond by asking you if you'd like your name shared with anybody else working on that legislation. And in that way, there is maintenance of confidentiality, yet there's an opportunity for contact if both members agree. So that's, I would envision this not interfering at all with that kind of relationship.
Well, if two people know it, it's not confidential in this building anyway. And personally, to have an official natural resources policy administrator for the state, you know I have the highest esteem for you, Senator Farioli.
But thank you.
I remember when I first started working in this building, and I went to the office of the man who has Brad's job, and all over the walls, Earth First posters, all this, you know, and which was his right to proclaim, you know. And the natural resources is policy, I mean, belief. I mean, we just saw the whales up there in Canada, I mean, Washington State, wherever it was. There are such strong views on either side. I just don't know how that, and it's such a political, it's like homeschool, no homeschool. How can the state create an office for, you know, one side of that contentious situation? I don't know what the purpose of this natural resource policy administrator, because what they would be administrating, how could they administrate that the Forest Service already isn't doing, or the Ag Department isn't already doing, or the water. You know, I just don't, it's such a contentious issue to have a state government official view concerns me, because if the people I agreed with were in power, I'd say, right on, I'm tired of using my sugar bowl money to promote my cause. But if the other side is in power, I don't want tax dollars used to promote their cause. And it seems like we're growing government.
Mr. Chairman, to Senator Shannon, we are. There's no question about that. Senator, the issue is that in the current iteration, we have very limited potential to do research across the biennium. We have lots of help during the session, but after the session, the building empties out and the staff is scaled back, and we're left with mostly part-time committee staff or part-time office staff, individual staff. This bill, Senate Bill 1320, would create in the legislative branch, which now does not currently have this tool, a tool that is very similar to the Governor's Natural Resource Office in the executive branch.
Oh, he has one too.
Yes, I think they are 13 to 18 full-time equivalencies in that. And the governor from time to time can draw research staff from all 125-plus state agencies if he needs them. The fact is that we probably need to be looking in a proactive vein on natural resource issues. We need someone to serve the legislative branch, and legislators to inform our decisions. So that's what this bill would do. It creates this administrator, not in the executive, but in the legislative branch.
Great.
And, Mr. Chairman, I will yield the microphone to Senator Corcoran for a presentation.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Tony Corcoran, Senate District 22. As Senator Ferrioli has very aptly covered the Dash 1s, the only comments I would make is that the insertion of the language on line 6 of the Dash 1 amendments is simply to acknowledge that Section 4 was going away, and it was a place to keep it in the bill. And the only comments I have, I've been thinking a lot about this confidentiality issue, and I would tend to want more of the confidentiality that exists in dealing with legislative fiscal and legislative revenue than the absolute confidentiality that exists in legislative council. And the reason for that is almost as much budgetary as anything else. If you have a nonpartisan leadership selected person, and I want to acknowledge Senator Ferrioli's willingness to work on that issue, which was sort of the biggest concern I had initially. If you have this nonpartisan unit, then you could run into problems with a level of confidentiality in that you may have an administrator who is inundated with requests for information and research, and there would have to be some way for that person to deal with their administrator and talk about what's feasible and what isn't. I mean, ostensibly, between the devious minds of Senator Ferrioli and myself, we could probably come up with two full research components. Just, you know, out of the blue for someone that would keep them totally occupied and not available to the other people. I know when you go into legislative revenue and you want a run, a school run at 4.95, Mr. Myers will tell you that someone else has already requested that. He won't tell you who requested it, but he will tell you that he'll make that available based on the fact that a similar thing was requested by somebody else. I don't mind that level of confidentiality. I would think that, you know, even though it is a politically contentious area, facts are facts, science is science, you know, and research is research. So I'm not convinced that it would be that far off the contentiousness that exists around the budget, but numbers are numbers. So I guess what I'm saying is I don't have a real big dog in the fight.
in terms of confidentiality, other than I really wouldn't like to see a bill that gave legislative council type protection to this natural resource director. So I think that's the only distinction between our amendments.
Thank you. It this reminds me of slightly the structure of the Office of Management and Budget for Congress, and that is a mild amount of confidentiality in terms of you don't necessarily reveal who has brought forward the question. But at the same time, when that is compiled and made available, it's made available to everyone. And to me, that's just sort of useful. I don't know. To put it at the same level as legislative counsel, I mean, it isn't an attorney-client relationship. We're simply asking someone who is there as an administrator to provide us with information that we need to make a reasonable decision. And that does not rise to the level of being an attorney-client relationship. And so I just personally, I kind of have a hard time with the absolute. I see nothing wrong with releasing the fact that we are working on coming up with data suggesting that three dams were removed at such and such a point, the economic impact and the whatever impact on a particular region. I mean, that gets people interested, gets them involved, it gets them doing their own research. I mean, I see nothing wrong with that.
Chairman, I think all of our members may have a different view of the definition of confidentiality. I tend to see it as either you got it or you don't got it. It's kind of like being 50 years old, Mr. Chairman. You're either 50 or you're not.
You're either armed or you're not, Mr. Chairman.
That's true. You don't go there. So I believe that level of confidentiality harms nothing. In fact, if no results come out of this, that is, no legislation is proposed, obviously the confidentiality would be maintained. And just as obvious, if you bring a bill forward, everybody's going to know what the research was. But there are some things in the natural resource area that legislators would want to work on that I think they want to keep a confidentiality about, not because there's such sensitive and secret information in natural resources, but because it affects somebody's legislative agenda. And, you know, that ought to be at the complete control of the legislator. However, I would like to see us consider the -2 amendments. They accomplish every objective without dealing with the issue of confidentiality. And my good colleague from Cottage Grove and I will research the issue of confidentiality, find out if it comes in black, charcoal, gray, and midnight blue, and bring it before the House Committee and deal with the issue there. We're running out of time, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Duke. Yes, we are. I'm going to remind you all of that.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ferrioli just helped me make up my mind that the confidentiality piece affects somebody's ability to move their legislative agenda. That's not what we're here for, Senator. We're here for to do the business. We're here for, that's good English, to do the business of the people. And one of the things I've struggled with in another committee that I'm on this session, Mr. Chair, has been behind closed door discussions. It has not advanced the needs of that committee. If you're going to come together as this position, Natural Resources Policy Administrator, I assume, is a Natural Resources Committee, you have to have open access to the information that's out there, and you've got to be able to share. And the notion that we're going to have committee members that have to protect their own stuff and their own legislative agenda doesn't get us down the road, doesn't get us to doing the people's business. And I guess I'm agreeing with Senator Wild. I think that we're not talking money here. This isn't budgets, that there's a whole budget strategy behind, that there's, and even those things we discuss fairly openly. I think to put in statute that committee members are going to be able to give this person matter. I don't know what a matter is, but a matter to do something with and that person is not allowed to reveal that to anyone else, is a far more divisive thing for a committee to try to deal with. And I don't, like I said, I don't think it gets you down the road to finding solutions. Because to find solutions, you've got to work together. And how many members, how many staff people, you compare this to the governor's natural resources section, and then said they had, I don't remember, 13, 15, 17, whatever, a bunch of people. How many people are you expecting, anticipating, will be in this?
Mr. Chairman, initially one.
And we know they're going to have an assistant because there's an assistant in here.
and the compensation and the amount of funding available would be subject to available resources, which are fairly scarce. So we'd have to have agreement by the co-chairs for any funding and all for this measure. So I would assume that we would start by hiring the administrator and an assistant and go from there. But I don't have a dollar amount that I can give you.
Well, the fiscal said $244,000. And two FTE, but you do anticipate that eventually there will be more than just the two people.
Mr. Chairman, that the Senate reduced the staff sufficient to serve the research needs of 90 people.
Don't we have that in legislative administration?
Mr. Chairman, the Senate reduced, we do, but we don't have the kind of expertise that we need for strategic planning and natural resources. And also, I appreciate the previous discussion. Thank you.
Senator Duke, I just have a question. I mean, I kind of struggled with the confidentiality based on your comments the other day. And how do you feel about, I mean, you're a veteran. How do you feel about the gradation of confidentiality of LC versus legislative revenue and legislative fiscal? Do you think there could be a way to maybe not have attribution to a particular individual on, say, a research request, but a record of requests made, for instance? Would that satisfy your concern?
I guess I've never seen much in the way of confidentiality with fiscal and revenue. I've worked more with revenue staff over the years, but every committee administrator has some. If a chair tells them to go to a particular direction or have amendments drafted or a bill drafted or something, they'd be stupid to go out and start talking about that. I mean, that's just the way it is in this building. And so you get, and that's why I don't understand the need to put it in the bill, because there is a certain amount of that that's inherent in committee staff today. They know who the boss is. It's whoever's running the committee. But I haven't seen the rest of that. I've had a pretty relaxed relationship with the other staff. LC is clear. Their lawyers were their clients. They defend us in court. They do all kinds of stuff for us. So there may be some middle ground there. I don't know.
Let me ask all three of you then. What staff do you look at if you have a 65-person?
I mean, I'm sure that both parties confidential. If you want to know about it, ask me and I will give them permission. That would be the natural balance that would develop anyway.
Mr. Chairman, that's exactly what the language accomplishes. Unless the member specifically requests that the information be kept confidential, it would fall under that less than strict standard of confidentiality. However, I can envision situations where you would want to do the research, take that research through several steps, which may create different questions, and then bring forth a coordinated program, any element of which might be, if we're published, might create a constituency base, activate an information campaign, make compromises impossible because of hardening political positions. I mean, all this has been in the building, and you know that we have confidentiality in our draft for a reason. And I guess years ago, without confidentiality, people's names would magically appear on legislation that was suspiciously similar to other people's legislation, and that's what engendered the confidentiality rule.
But, Mr. Chair, I mean, just to offer the other side of that coin, I watched in my two sessions bills that were introduced under the name of one legislator. As soon as they were introduced, no longer confidential, they went nowhere, and a bill of the majority party went somewhere with the same stuff. So I think that is part of what Senator Duke is pointing to,
sort of the nature of the beast here in the building. I'm more concerned about when it's at the Natural Resource Department level. And they're doing, I mean, you could just imagine how unwieldy it would become if there was total confidentiality and every person that went in there, that administrator couldn't talk to other members of the 90-person body about what they're doing. It could get pretty out of hand pretty quickly. So,
yeah. Mr. Chairman.
Effectively reduce the standoff here, so yes, inefficient.
Just as if the person who brings the matter before the administrator designates the matter as confidential. It doesn't say it has to be.
But, Mr. Chair, Senator Fisher, everybody could.
And, Mr. Chair, we have plenty of things that are declared confidential around. I think you're involved in several of them. As employee representatives and stuff like that, you do a lot of stuff in confidentiality.
You mean a regular job?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Why not here?
Oh, I don't have any problem with confidentiality that exists, Mr. Chair, Senator Fisher, with confidentiality that exists in the Legislative Council.
I'm talking about in here.
Well, I think that you run into, I mean, I'm just thinking of this programmatically. If you have a true nonpartisan department, and I understand the interest in this from Senator Farioli's perspective that the governor has ongoing staff, the legislature has none, and they used to have staff doing policy. I think that's a critical piece. I really do. I think it would save off a lot of the arguments that we get in this body, frankly. I think it would solve a lot of problems. But I don't think the confidentiality per se is a big problem solver in this, because to the extent that you spring surprises on people, to the extent that you exclude people from what's going on in your mind, that's where you get the clashes. And you know, I'm not sure that it needs to be any greater confidence than what now exists in legislative fiscal and legislative revenue, which is that they'll tell you that they're doing something. You know, I've talked to legislative revenue about all sorts of tax questions that I've had over three cycles, and I'll say, prepare a document at 1%, 3%, and 5%. They hold that confidential. But if somebody else comes to them and says, do the same thing, they'll say, I'm presenting one of these to Senator Corcoran. Would you like to talk to them? You know, this is a little, the way that the language is in here and the reason I asked to be removed is it was more on the LC standard that I was seeing anyway. And Senator Farioli has agreed that we could both look to legislative fiscal and revenue and see if they have different standards than the attorney-client standards that exist in legislative council. I think Senator Dukes made a really good point. The confidentiality as a point of policy is a very questionable strategy. You know, you really do just, you'll run into a wall every time. That's why the left and the right don't succeed in this building, succeed in this building in the middle wins.
Mr. Chairman, I think those are good arguments. I guess I just put forward this other additional thing to think about. Any one of us, if in the process of developing a comprehensive view, and in natural resources, you very often have to know the answer to several questions and have continuity. Any one of us could be subjected to incredible pressure and almost intolerable opposition that can be activated with a series of phone calls and a couple of faxes. And I guess I would want the members not to have to worry about having the design or a what-if kind of policy made public or shared in the building before they've been able to bring a concept all the way through to the place where they're ready to bring it forth for the questions that inevitably attend these issues. And I can think of irrigation issues or cattle ranching or timber harvesting issues or all kinds of different things where there's relatively complicated policies that are, you need sequential steps and good logic, and you want to be able to answer all the questions before you have to face the glare of public policy debate. And that's what the confidentiality issue is for. It has nothing to do with decisions behind closed doors. It does have to do with protecting a question until it's been fully enough developed to be able to be brought forward. And I would say that that is exactly why we have levels of confidentiality in the other administrator offices in this building. Having said all that, I will work with the good senator to try and answer the question about what latitude there are in confidentiality. But I'll remind the committee that the issue before us initially was broadening the approval authority so that we reflected by time. I agreed to bring that amendment. Here it is. It does what we said it would do. Adding another consideration at this point in time may just be slowing us in the processes. I want to move forward, Mr. Chairman.
And I was going to point out that we do need to recognize that the issue is here is do we believe that we need additional support in this area of natural resource research? And my answer to that is yes. And I hope we don't get bogged down over the fine definition of what is confidential. Senator Dukes.
That's a good point. Do we need to spend $250,000 to set up more staff? But I raised the issue of confidentiality in the first hearing. So, not a new issue. Mm-hmm. Not for me, anyway.
I think we've heard enough debate, Mr. Chairman. If the committee is ready to work, let's work.
All right. Thank you. Did I understand you that you were moving the DAC 2? Okay, let me clarify. I believe I opened this as a work session, but just officially declare this as if we're in a work session on Senate Bill 1320. Senator Scarioli,
okay. Oh, so are we to discussion or has he made the official motion? Oh, we weren't in work session. Okay.
I have moved, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Senator Ferrioli has moved the Dash 2 amendments to Senate Bill 1320. Is there any discussion about that? Because I think that's where we are. Senator Weil.
Thank you very much. Sorry for the earlier interruption. Okay. Yes. If we were to adopt the Dash 2 amendments, would we also be allowed to adopt the Dash 1? Seeing as how they're redundant, I'm just curious as to the procedure here.
We could vote on them.
Mr. Chairman, a straight up or down vote on the Dash 2 amendments would answer the question that the Senator has brought.
All right, that's good. Okay, the clerk will call the roll. Open it, Senator Davis.
No, I just wanted to make one comment. What you just said, I think, is at the heart of my objections. You said we're all family here.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not where you get with the confidentiality piece.
Mm-hmm. Something that we had happen about a week ago, and that is where a friend of mine on the House side couldn't get a bill moved. So we brought it over there, and we put my name on it, and I put his name on it, and we brought it in and passed it. So even though that was a Democrat and a Republican, we recognize the clerk will call a roll on the Dash 2 amendments to 1320.
Yep.
Aye.
Fisher.
Aye.
Senator Shannon.
Aye.
Aye.
And the third passed. Chairman, I move Senate Bill 1320 as amended to the floor with a DPAS recommendation.
Okay.
I hope you've got enough.
You want to? I've
got to know what I mean.
Would you be available to open that and electorate and vote on the Dash 1?
Mr. Chairman, I withdraw my motion.
I will move the Dash 1 amendments as the 1320.
Senator Wild has moved to Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 1320. If there's any further discussion, clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
Aye.
No.
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 Aye.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to move the Senate Bill 1320 as amended to the floor with a DPAS recommendation.
Senator Ferrioli has moved Senate Bill 1320 as amended to the floor with a DPAS. Is there any further discussion?
As amended.
Mr. Sherman, never mind, I have my... Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Let me restate that one more time. Senate Bill, Senator Perioli has moved Senate Bill 1320 as amended to the floor with a new pass. There's no further discussion. Clerk will call the roll.
Senator
Aye. Senator Bill 1320 has amended and has been passed and sent to the floor with a due pass. And Senator Perioli, would you like to carry that?
A pleasure, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I would like to again offer to work with Senator Corcoran or any other member in the committee who would like to explore the issue of confidentiality and the shades of gray, if there are such, and if there are is a middle ground on the confidentiality issue, I'd be happy to explore it on the House side if anybody wishes to do that.
Senator Duke.
I have a question.
Mm-hmm.
How can you send a bill with a $234,000 fiscal impact to the floor?
Okay, at this opportunity, there were a few of us who missed votes, and what I'm going to do, I can either go through a complicated process of opening each one of them. Without objection, Brad, I'll have you read the votes that we know were missed, and each person can record. Without objection, can record their vote on those.
Chair, members of the committee, on my record keeping, Senator Dukes and Ferrioli did not record votes on House Bill 2118.
How do you vote? 2118?
House Bill 2118 directs the State Board of Agriculture in consultation with the State Weed Board to implement study on impact of noxious weeds and effectiveness of current weed control programs.
Aye.
Aye.
Mr. Chair, I believe Senator Dukes and Senator Perioli also did not record their votes on SJM 13.
Aye.
Aye.
I was missing on one
without recommendation.
And at this time, I'm going to close the work session on Senate Bill 1320, and I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 1028. That tells us where we are with amendments.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we have -5 amendments to Senate Bill 1028. These amendments are identical to the -4 amendments with the following exceptions. On page 16, line 18, we deleted the words and implement. Page 16, line 30, we deleted implementing and inserted developing. Page 17, line 27, we deleted and implement. And the Mr. Chair, the impact of those changes was to reduce the fiscal by asking Department of Environmental Quality and Department of Agriculture to develop these programs that were referenced, but not to implement them, thereby having a significant savings in terms of the fiscal impact. Mr. Chair, we also acted on recommendations for Terry Witt from Oregonians Food and Shelter to clarify section 13 on page 10 and section 14 on page 12 to clarify that the posting requirements for pesticide use at parks, schools, and child care facilities are mandatory on those facilities, but no others. And then Department of Forestry asked us on page 18, line 8, to clarify that pesticides used on forest lands would be, and other hazardous substances used on, I misspoke, applied to forest lands would be the subject of their recording. They were concerned that the phrase used on might subject them to recording for inadvertent things such as gasoline and other unintentional applications. And similarly, on page 18, line 17, we deleted established and inserted developed. And Mr. Chair, oh, and additionally, Mr. Chair, we adopted recommendations from the Department of Agriculture by Lorna Young to tighten up some of the language with regard to their department as well. And I believe Chuck Craig is here as well if you wanted to address those, but those were overviewed by the committee and adopted as Lorna had requested.
Okay. Is there any second? Are you okay with that?
I was just recalling the statements about posting of if a licensed applicator has to be the one who posts. Did we deal with that in the ones you ran through? Because the expense of having a licensed applicator run out to pound in a sign seems a little frivolous. It just occurred to me, I didn't hear that come out, and so I'm wondering if in fact that was dealt with.
Mr. Chair, Senator Wild, we did request that for the legislative council, we requested in sections 8 through 14 to clarify that each school, park, or child care facility is responsible for posting requirements, not the pesticide applicator or operator, unless those are one and the same. And in reading the amendments, it appears to me that they did do that.
What we're going to do, let's just stand these for a few minutes while we review these.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, you asked me to clarify an earlier conversation I had with Lorna Young from the Department of Agriculture. I asked her what the fiscal impact would be after we removed the implementing language, and she informed me that the fiscal impact to the Department of Agriculture would be zero in as much as they could use existing staff resources to coordinate a program with the Department of Environmental Quality. Possibly we have Lorna Young, I'm sorry, we have Lori Onan here, I think Lori was going to see if she could discern whether their fiscal impact would diminish significantly as well.
Lori, could you come up and kind of help us out? That's probably a question for some of our members.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Lori Onan, Department of Environmental Quality. I did talk to our water quality staff today after seeing the Dash 5 amendments, and their thought was that it would, to develop the program that's outlined here, which does actually involve a significant kind of analysis in terms of looking at all water quality limited streams, identifying different issues, including ways to estimate source and location for what you find in the water or what you might find in the water. So their thought was it would be about 0.5 FTE, about $80,000 to do this program, to develop a program. And also wanted me to comment, if I had the chance, that what we might find in developing a program with the Department of Ag is that you wouldn't want to test all water quality limited streams in the state.
Right.
And that's something that I think we would get more information on.
That seemed to be some concern of the committee, that we were kind of an overkill on the amount of testing that would be done, and it is in fact minimal testing and found out there was no problem, but then in fact you could just drop that from the list, maybe check it in a on a regular basis. We certainly didn't want to have spending all the dollars just going out for the samples, but if you can see the direction of this thing, is we need to know more about the quality of that water.
Mr. Chair, if I could make one other comment, and that's actually on a different section, Section 21. We had a little bit of discussion about this in terms of requiring DEQ to inform the health division when something, when we think there might be a problem with drinking water. And I wanted to reiterate again that this is not our role. We don't feel comfortable with this section of the bill at all. And certainly would hope there would be further discussion. I understand this bill might go to Ways and Means.
One of the questions that arises in this issue right here, and that I think bothers at least some members of this committee, is the idea that for us to discover that no, that doesn't seem to be anyone's responsibility. And so, you know, hopefully from the process of developing a plan, this would be at least a plan is who's going to address the idea of the condition of a stream, particularly where, in fact, someone might be considering pulling water out for human consumption.
Mr. Chair, I understand the concern. I think it is a difficult issue in terms of there are standards out there that are commonly used to determine when something can be safe or can be treated to be safe, and there are things that aren't known about some conditions, and it would take, I think, a lot more investigation. One of the concerns that we had was whether the science is at a point where you could ever really know, and making recommendations on that basis. So.
It isn't easy. I mean, as we heard from the other day, I mean, what was the 6 criteria? And we were dealing, asking the question about, well, of those 56 or so, whatever, and you're dealing with 110,000 hazardous materials, how do you ever address that? Or how many of them are actually picked up in that initial analysis? Probably don't cover them all. And so that would tell you that you probably need to know more about the science of what's happening with that water source.
Mr. Chair, that's a good assessment. Also, I think that's when you also get into the higher cost. It'd be more, requires additional resources.
Absolutely. And probably, hopefully, out of the process of at least examining this, we can start to get an idea of what processes may be necessary to accomplish that. And hopefully, we're going to have EPA stepping up and doing more in this area. They seem to be dealing with that. Coming out from the administration and EPA, yes, we're going to focus more on knowing what is happening with water quality. So.
Oh, that's okay. I'd like to go back to Section 18. Lori, you're supposed to develop a coordinated program. Are you planning on using it too? It's not really a facetious question. It's just I know it can cost more if you have to have the people to go out and use it than it is just to... with this language.
Mr. Chair, Senator Duke, one would assume that one wouldn't go through the work to develop something if it was never going to be used. I mean, that's certainly something to consider. I think that part of the difficulty of knowing, you know, how long this would take and what would be involved would be to say, what are we going to use this for and why? So that would be part of the discussion. That's kind of why we had concerns about the scope of this. It was a very broad scope about designing a very big program. We might not need it that big. And then, of course, it gets to the point of where we've developed it. Now do we have the money to do anything with it?
So for the next biennium, you would just anticipate the $80,000 to develop the program, and then we decide after that what we do with it?
Mr. Chair, Senator Dukes, this, as you know, as was just described, this bill originally was written that we would develop and implement. Now, implement's been taken out, so I guess that it sounds like the intent of the bill at this point would be to just develop something and then report back, I guess, reporting back in the later section of the bill. And
right.
I guess it's my understanding that at this point we would not be implementing anything.
Okay. That is the part of the bill that we're going to want to make sure we preserve those ideas. Legislature, particularly the interim committees, informed about that progress.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, originally we did have implement in there, and actually in discussing this, we thought we don't even know what they're going to develop. How do you fund something if you don't know the structure of how many FTE I mean, what it's going to involve in terms of perhaps hardware, software, other things, and it's very hard to fund something that you don't know what it's going to look like.
Nevertheless, it's probably better to know the exact structure of your program prior to asking for the actual parts you're going to use to implement these things. This might be a little slower this way, but at least the analysis can be done, and then it can come under scrutiny and can be decided, okay, we agree or disagree with the rationale. So, personally.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Fisher.
When it talks about testing the water and all these streams every 6 months, that just allow for a one-point test? Doesn't say anything about it.
That would fall under the category of they should develop a program that would attempt to address that. Now, we may come to the conclusion as they develop that, that's just ridiculously expensive and maybe unnecessary. Ideally, we had folks from some of the watershed committees and soil conservation districts. Discussed earlier, we would have a set of circumstances in which if you did not have a problem on a watershed, you'd begin to drop those off. I think that would be part of developing the process, is to tell us, based upon what we do know now, and how you would implement the things that we're talking about here.
Mr. Chair, you didn't have a program where you tested it about every quarter of a mile of this stream length. How are you going to know? I mean, you're going to allow them to test at one place and then say the whole stream's polluted?
Yeah, and that is that was one of the things. If I still don't have it, in other words, if it's there, I know this stuff. Solid, but that's the point source. So it's a real simple process of sampling, and that's one of the reasons that the focus of making sure that the lab is coordinated so that.
Mr. Chair, the disinfectants and all those kind of things are still ruled out?
You will be here. Pop up as possibly needed.
I mean, they don't have to get a notification.
Kitchen?
What?
Kitchen?
You already have to post it on the door.
Mm-hmm. Well, so the posting requirements, you know, literally are that. And, that, and see, that's a Senator Fisher, I mean, I can't, they're looking to give me the exact position of that. But one of the things that was discussed was the idea if you're going to have the contact person, remember we discussed that earlier, that person will be able to make decisions about what they think they should post. And,
okay, we still have to.
Right. Page 9, line 6, are you there?
Yeah.
Okay. Set up a person who would be the contact person. They can make those decisions as far as...
Oh, but I say we're still going to allow them to put those out?
No, it wouldn't be. In other words, if I was dealing with, like, concentrated chlorine and I was the person responsible at a school or a park, I may think, okay, wait a minute, I read the label, this material is this, and I haven't diluted it yet, so if I'm going to use it at this concentration level, I'm going to note it. Because, you know, I do something like that. So part of the process here is you're going to have a qualified applicator who is going to be at a location. Once you understand toxic materials, you understand a lot of toxic materials, even if, in fact, that may be a disinfectant, sanitizer, or a deodorizer, and a base station. These things have labels on them. They're going to have a material safety data sheet, you know, present at those locations. And that, and that's why I think it would be a case of them using good discretion to describe and, you know, or warn what might be of risk to children or staff.
Yeah, but you're ruling out here by law the whole group of people that don't have to be concerned with that, right?
That's correct. And we did this primarily because of objections from those folks, if I remember correctly, within the school and child care facility, who were suggesting that these were basically going to be using off-the-shelf materials and for disinfectant sanitizers, and therefore they didn't believe it would be necessary. Process that was necessary, as far as notice was considered in the other parts of the bill. They could do that.
Don't farmers use off-the-shelf products just the same as anybody else?
That's correct. And I don't have to notice for material unless it's a class of material. There's some materials I can spray without having to put in post notice. Others I post notice. And that's
with
what,
this legislation?
No, the current existing legislation.
I understand that, but not with this legislation. So if you can't...
Part of the microbial and the...
No, if you as a farmer are no longer going to be able to use off-the-shelf stuff, why should anybody else be able to use off-the-shelf stuff?
Yeah, I'm sorry. I should have looked to you initially.
No, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. No.
What's the question?
If these things are so important, then I maintain everybody has to be involved.
Eight station, okay, which is listed here. If I'm a commercial applicator, if I were at a school, I think I would do more file my figure out. I might go get my hand inside of there and see what is that crazy stuff. It obviously is to get Senator
Dick. Mr. Chair, I'm a little confused here. Under the, well, Section 8, we're going and setting up, and the rest of my friends, we're setting up a hazardous substance use posting program. Now, under hazardous substance, it includes pesticides and any hazardous substance defined as, and without looking at 453, that's pesticide says does not include any antimicrobial, whatever, agent, such as et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
Hazardous doesn't say that. And the program we're setting up is a hazardous substance use posting program. So what I'm wondering is, under hazardous, do we get into those sanitizers and deodorizers and base stations? So are we actually posting for those in schools and child care facilities?
Chuck, could you come up here? Do you know anything about this issue? Could you?
Okay. Well, then welcome, Ned. That is just work out just fine for the hearing. Then come on up here.
Outside my area.
Is it really?
Mr. Chair, Chuck Craig with the Department of Ag. If they are classified as a pesticide that under the definition that we regulate, we could conceivably regulate some of them, yeah. But I just have no knowledge of this specifically
is there anybody else here that doesn't know anything?
Like to come on up.
Mr. Chair, do we know who regulates 453?
I'm looking, but
there's nobody here. 453?
No, 453 is the state fire marshal.
Fire marshal? Okay. But as far as the actual usage of it, that would be reporting of it. That's the definition. And we switch over here, but we go back to the definition of pesticide on 634. And that's what Senator Fisher's question about.
Because it includes this stuff, then...
Antimicrobial agents such as disinfectants, sanitizers, deodorizers, used for cleaning purposes and base cases. Now, my thought is you were probably there's probably significant limitation. Would the health department say you can't use this because this is the only thing you're authorized for the cleaning purpose? I mean, I could clean the sink with gasoline and throw a match in where I'm done. And it probably wouldn't be an authorized use, but I could come in with chlorine or ammonia. Particularly what we're talking about, these facilities, child care facilities.
Mr. Chair, the thing that I'm talking about here is even some of the things like Comet that you could buy right off a grocer's shelf and take home or take to your business. If you wound up starting to use that stuff in a major way as to scrub shower walls and some things like that, you're in trouble. Get a whole lot more fumes than you want to put up with and deal with.
So if I could,
I don't mean to do a violation of anybody's brain name, but
mm-hmm. When you look down, each one of these groups is if you go down to section 9, education, shell,
program that is implemented by school districts and childcare facilities under this.
I can look at the broad spectrum of hazardous stuff.
Mr. Chair, also, a lot of these products come in a very strong solution and are not supposed to be used unless they are tremendously diluted. And there isn't anything talking about the storage of them or.
We don't have it. Because, I mean, even households now are
expected that, you know, if you endanger your children by having
certain children and family want to talk to you, something happens to that child, I'm sure
a child care facility or a school would have some process in mind. I mean, one of the reasons for this bill is because we can't answer these questions. In fact, nobody has a program.
Mr. Chair, can I throw something out here? My confusion is getting deeper. Section 10 talks about a hazardous substance use posting program, and I think
something along the term is used sometimes often. And we talk about the hazardous substances that may be used in the school district. But if you go to Section 13, it says if a pesticide is applied at a school or child care facility, then it goes and talks about posting. That's different than hazardous material. It's a more limited. That gets us back to not including the kitchen stuff. But, I mean, it seems to me that they're being used interchangeably. The Department of Education, Section 9, shall develop guidelines for a hazardous substance use posting program. And they're not interchangeable. I checked the hazardous substances section of the statute that's referred to, and it talks about any substance for which a material safety data sheet is required, etc. And if I recall testimony correctly, the last time around, they said that some of the household products have these, or make reference or are on, or whatever, these safety data sheets. So I think under hazardous materials, some of the household chemicals are included, but clearly under pesticides, the way it's defined here, they're not.
Mm-hmm.
So I just think that somebody needs to make it consistent. I don't care whether we're talking about hazardous materials or pesticides, we probably just ought to be consistently talking about the same one so that our expectations for signage are the same.
Well, and if you look at, you remember the yellow book that I brought in, which was a list of MSD sheets for my farm? One of the things when you open that up is you find out that for each product that you look at, depending on where it is in there, and has a reference, whether it's a pesticide, it's a cleaning agent, it's a solvent, it's a paint, that sort of stuff. You go there, you look at the MSD sheet, and many times, because depending on how they... And that's one reason that you do material safety data sheets. That, to me, seems to be developed. How you handle each one of these materials. I wish we had some of your from the school district. Probably now they have a procedure that they go through and handle. If I could real quickly, then have we lost them? We have three youth from Marion County, young farmers and ranchers. Why don't you come on up?
They're all my constituents.
Oh, they're your constituents?
Right, from Silverton and
Joe. All right. Well, it's going to be up to you. We either move this thing or we don't. Take a chair right there. Introduce yourselves. I'm glad to have you here. As you can see, we can take a bill. We can make it real easy.
Right.
Okay. Tell us how old you are, where you're from, and other than Marion County.
Oh, thank you.
My name is Destiny Chapin. I'm chair for Marion County Young Farmers and Ranchers. I'm 21, and I'm studying crop science at Oregon State University with a minor in political science.
Is that agronomy?
Yes.
All right.
My name is Troy Hadley. I'm 21. I'm from Silverton. I got my associate's degree in animal science. I farm up towards the falls, and I also have a job in Mount Angel.
My name is Celeste King. I'm also from the Silverton area. I'm 20 years old, and I'm studying animal science at Oregon State.
Well, welcome to you all. Good to have you here. You can just, if you feel comfortable, you want to just stay right there? If you want to ask any questions, well, you might check with me, but it's okay.
Okay, thank you.
Brad is going to go ahead and try to answer this question that he's been looking at. Brad Harper is our committee administrator, and we're going to see if we can work our way through the question.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm going to take a stab at trying to explain the issues raised by Senator Dukes. And admittedly, there is a little bit of confusion because what we did is we gave LC a task to develop what was existing bill. I believe it's Senate Bill 993. It was Senator Brown's pesticide bill within the hazardous substance framework that we were trying to develop here. And I think we can break it down into three sections. If you'll notice, Section 10 is the broadest section, which applies to school districts and child care facilities, and it gives them essentially direction to develop and implement a hazardous substance use posting program with some very limited requirements. For example, having the name, business address, and telephone number of the contact person required under the Section 11. And Section 11 further identifies things the schools and child care facilities need to do, for example, keeping material safety data sheets on record should, for example, a parent come in and want to know what substances are being used. Then the second part begins on Section 13, and this is the more detailed provisions regarding pesticide application as opposed to the broader hazardous substance application. Since the pesticide application at school or child care facilities, and that's where the Section 13 is the more narrower scope of the pesticide application, right, as opposed to hazardous substance application, the more restricted pesticide application at schools or child care facilities. And that is likely why we tied in pesticide definition back on page 9, mm-hmm. which dealt with the disinfectant, sanitizer, or deodorizer, because we were drawing a distinction between the Section 10 hazardous substance posting and the Section 13 pesticide application posting.
I believe the bill deals with, and I'm sorry I have not read completely through the amendments as it came out, but initially we were dealing with the fact that we have all
then, Mr. Chair, there is one more component, and that is Section 14, which is also applicable only to pesticides, and that has to do with applications at state or local parks. And you notice it has its own posting requirements, too.
Mr. Chair, take one more step at this one, and I think I quit. I understand a different level of requirement for posting for hazardous materials and for pesticides, as long as you change the definition, because right now hazardous substances include pesticides. And as long as it includes pesticides, you're going to have a lot higher level of posting for the pesticides too. Because every time you say what is required of hazardous materials, you're including pesticides.
Well, except for the pesticides, they didn't.
Not under hazardous substances. It says hazardous substances includes pesticides and any hazardous substances. And as long as you have the hazardous substances in there, you have included what you deleted from pesticides. And if that made any sense to you, it's this hour to really leave. I'm at the bottom of page 8.
Okay.
Okay.
I'm
sure you're
right.
Not at all.
Mr. Chair, Senator Duke, I think the point I was trying to make earlier is that Section 10 could be less restrictive in terms of reporting hazardous substances than pesticide reporting. Anytime a pesticide would be applied, you'd have to meet the stricter posting requirements that are set forth in detail. But other hazardous substances, not including pesticides, could be posted at a less restrictive level, so long as they met the minimum requirements of Section 10 and 11.
And you also have for schools a hazardous substances reporting.
Correct.
For example, if there was a hazardous substance being used at a school that wasn't a pesticide, the school might determine that simply posting posting on a bulletin board in a central area was sufficient to meet the requirements. Whereas if they were using a pesticide, they wouldn't have that leeway. They would be forced to go through all the requirements, for example, having signs up at 48 hours prior to the application at the application site and those sorts of requirements.
You're saying that pesticide is a higher posting than hazardous?
That's correct.
I don't know what's wrong with me. I looked at you four times. Like, what is wrong with my mind? You're trying to just like this.
Okay, everybody, state your name for the record and help us out here.
Mr. Chair, my name is Dave Miller. I'm with the State Fire Marshal's Office. Just for clarification, a hazardous substance is defined as any substance the manufacturer is required to provide a material safety data sheet under OSHA's requirements. That includes almost everything. It includes your disinfectants, such as mild detergents. If they're using quantities larger than you or I would use them in our homes. So if school using them, that would be included as hazardous substance, and they would, if I read this right, have to post for that.
Okay, most of them are going to have
OSHA has a hazard communication program. It's an employee right to know. It requires the schools to train their employees for any hazardous substances that they use, train them in the hazards associated with those. Not necessarily those for posting requirements at the school itself that I know.
Yes, I called my husband, who's really involved in this, and he said that no school district employee applies any pesticides without being licensed by the DEQ and knows all of the dangers and all of the solutions that should be used and all of that. And I just have a question, because I'm not really into this bill, but do farmers now have to post the size of the road, what they're spraying and the days they're spraying?
Under certain, if we're using restricted use pesticide, you must post. And you write on there the date of the application. You don't have it.
One of the bigger signs
has all the requirements on it. In fact, we have somebody nodding their head. You want to go ahead and comment on this? We welcome you in here.
Oh, Adam, just
go ahead and state your name for the record.
Troy Hadley. It's just that I've gone through the program. I have my private applicator's license, and not that I, on our farm, we don't use any, but I do. I work for a row crop farm when we do on all the vegetables, especially on the edible crops. Mm-hmm. Everything has to be, you have to have post of what it is.
And if it's restricted, you have to have recording that application, all kinds of data.
Yeah, keep all kinds of records.
So what we're suggesting here in the bill is that a licensed applicator, then in fact that person, so that school district, that facility,
neighbor requirements, okay.
And that, based upon that, they'll set up a posting process so that those
will be enforced.
Yeah, well, that's what you want to do. I just have to tell you right now that I really have great respect for the sponsors of this bill, but I can't figure a way how to heal it, so I'm a no vote. Just want to tell you that.
Okay.
Is that all right? Okay.
And that's what we said we were going to do. We've made the best shot we can do.
Mm-hmm.
Are we going to do something with this bill, Mr. Chair?
We're
going to jawbone it to death.
Well, I would like to correct something here. We've been criticized in the past for moving things too quickly without adequate discussion, and that's why this has gone on to this point. And so, just for the record, I'd like to clarify what was just said. Would you like to, Senator Watt?
Thank you, sir.
Are we in work session?
Oh,
yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Second. Okay.
Days on end in work session. I would move the dash 5 amendments to SB 1028.
Senator Wilde has moved the dash 5 amendments to Senate Bill 1028. Is there any objection?
SB 1028 as amended to waive the rules with a
Senator Wilde has moved Senate Bill 1028 with the as amended with dash 5 to the Ways and Means Committee with a with a due pass. Is there any further discussion?
Will there be, Mr. Chair? There be an opportunity to submit a minority report?
Can't. I was just told you can't.
Ways and Means would have to do it.
Did it have a prior record?
Oh, I
have some things, Tracy.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I spoke with leadership and they said anything with a greater than $50,000 fiscal impact will automatically.
So it is headed
to
the
so that was a reasonable motion.
Okay.
Sure. Do we know what the fiscal is at this point?
Well,
they're still developing.
Right.
Yeah. 80, I could go a lot more than that.
Once they pay the kids to figure out what the hell it says, it'll be about $9 million.
As long as they pay a minimum
billion,
which minimum wage? They're under 18, forget it.
Any further discussion relative to Senate Bill 1028? Being none, the clerk will call the roll.
No.
No.
I just want a wall.
That's all right.
Go ahead.
Well, we need to consult with Senator Fisher. I don't know. I really, I don't want
to. I'm not letting you.
Well, I've never seen such a long vote.
Yeah, this is a long vote.
Okay, maybe you better move on to me.
Yeah.
Aye.
Aye.
Okay, I will say aye. If you want to move along there. Okay.
You have four eyes, don't
you? Yeah, four eyes.
Yeah, you can condemn
them. Yeah.
You made me vote aye.
Yes. Senate Bill 1028, as amended, has been sent to Ways and Means with the Goose Act. And if you refer to this as 1040, you're ready.